What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Hypertrophy Cast. My name is Luis Frielingsdorf. I'm the podcast host. And we are joined again by Dr. Eric Helms, who has been on the podcast before. It was in December of 2019. Back then, we talked about training as an advanced athlete. We talked about volume increases, lower volume phases, resensitization. So if you haven't check that episode out yet, go do so. And since then we've met at the WNBF seminar in Munich. And so glad to have you on back here. Eric, how has 2020 been going for you so far?
I mean, probably like most people, not great, but all things considered, I think I'm grateful for where I am in the world, with New Zealand being a really good place as far as COVID. But no, it's an honor to be back on. It was good to meet you in Munich, and looking forward to the chat today.
Sweet. 2019, you competed in strongman and bodybuilding. And you mentioned in our last conversation that 2020 is like a year where you want to complete the strength sport triangle, so to speak. Competition in a strongman, powerlifting, and weightlifting. Any changes to that due to the epidemic, or is that
yes? The plan? No, there was some changes. So I was training for 7 weeks at home with just a barbell and 90 kilos of weight. And the weightlifting comp that I was targeted to do, of course, was canceled. The strongman competition was postponed, and I really could only focus on weightlifting with the only having 90 kilos. And, so I made a lot of progress there and kind of wanted to keep focusing on it. So right now the goal is to compete in a weightlifting comp, in the first weekend of August, and then potentially do Masters Nationals, because Masters for weightlifting is over 35, not over 40. And that would be in October. And I may have an opportunity to kind of do the trifecta, because there is a November powerlifting comp and then a December. It's actually technically a Highland Games competition. It's like it's run by the same strongman organization. It's called Backyard Highland Games. So it's the kind of thing where I could probably go into it with minimal training, have fun, and I would still technically complete the trifecta. Yeah. But it would be like Highland Games powerlifting and weightlifting. So, I mean, that still counts, but we'll see. Right now, kind of the main focus is weightlifting, and I'm training pretty much just for that, with a little bit of bodybuilding accessory work, not to lose any muscle mass, and non-weightlifting specific muscle groups all the way through October. So, yeah, COVID threw a wrench in the plans, but I'm making lemonade.
Highland Games. Is that a competition where the competitors wear like these Scottish skirts?
Kilts, yeah? My friend, yes.
Oh, that's the name.
That's the name, yeah. So I will have to see if that's required regalia for the competition. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to wear a kilt. I'm down. I do have some Scottish blood in me, so
going to be funny. Nice. Yeah. Cool. So let's dive right into the topic for today. It will be all around like assessing progress as an hypertrophy athlete. And back in episode 14, we talked about volume increases, and it became pretty clear. Please correct me if I'm wrong, that you like to make modifications to your training when progress is not occurring. So ultimately, it becomes really important to gauge whether you are progressing or not. And if yes, are you progressing at the appropriate rate, of course, in relation to your level of advancement, your goals, and of course, your life circumstances. So if we are just going to take a step back, how would you define progress for an hypertrophy athlete? I mean, at first, that may sound like a really simplistic question, but people are, in my opinion, often missing the forest before the trees. What we basically want is muscle growth. And what most people are chasing are basically higher numbers in the gym. And I mean, that's completely reasonable, as we don't have access to an MRI or a DEXA to measure our muscle hypertrophy. So ultimately, training performance becomes one of our most valuable tools in order to identify whether we are building muscle or not, right?
You know, that's a very good characterization. It's kind of like it's unfortunate because gauging strength progress is self-evident. You know, if you're lifting heavier weights to get stronger, you're getting stronger because you're lifting heavier weights, you know, and so long as those weights keep getting heavier, you know, you're stronger. But muscle hypertrophy is, it's the kind of thing where you don't, like you said, you don't have access to an MRI or an ultrasound. So you're basically putting all the ingredients in and hoping that a muscular cake comes out of the oven, you know? Mm. So oftentimes this will look like you want to see some reasonable rate of body weight gain to ensure that you are in a calorie surplus. You tick a bunch of nutritional boxes, you know, protein, meal frequency, a few other things. You tick the recovery boxes, making sure that you're sleeping well enough, you're managing your stress levels, etc. And then, of course, you tick a bunch of training boxes. And there are some indications of strength performance that are helpful because if all else is equal, eventually you having bigger muscles should show up on the bar or the cable stack. Mm-hmm. You know, that while we don't exactly know what is contributing to whole muscle hypertrophy, we know that a large portion of it, if you're doing progressive resistance training, is going to be contractile tissue. And mm-hmm. certainly there are fitness fatigue dynamics. You know, the training you do to get more muscle, which results in strength, also produces fatigue. You know, that's muscle damage, psychological fatigue. There's other types of fatigue. You know, short term in the same session, you can have central fatigue and systemic fatigue. Peripheral fatigue. And all of that can make it a little unclear as to whether or not your strength being suppressed is because you're not growing or whether it's just because you're fatigued. So essentially, you have to figure out what reasonable time frame and what signal to noise ratio would you expect to start seeing some type of strength progress over time. And if that's coinciding with all those other ticked boxes, then that's about the best you can do without an MRI or an ultrasound.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of variables and a lot of things to consider when looking at training performance, as you already mentioned, and we'll dive a little bit deeper into those factors later down the conversation. And I think you always have to distinguish also training progression from just basically working harder in the gym. So if I had to make like a clear definition, it would be something like an increase of repetition maximum in a movement with a given weight, a given movement quality, and also, as you said, like a fatigue level. And what is interesting is that you don't really have to test your strength every block or push to complete failure in order to know whether you have progress, as you can just see the number of repetitions and the number of reps in reserve you had, and that equates to a repetition maximum with you, what you basically can compare to previous numbers. Yeah.
Yep.
So
Do you mind if I clarify that a little bit?
Sure.
So essentially, as you progress through being a quote unquote beginner, quote unquote intermediate, quote unquote advanced lifter, which only does not mean how much you lift or how big you are compared to other people. It's all in comparison to where you probably can get in your own genetic limitations. The issue is one of signal to noise, right? So early on in your career, like I remember in the first 6 months of my training, I probably put on 20 pounds of muscle. You know, and I'm 6 foot, so that's not like a huge amount, but it's every time I train the same movement, I could do more reps and more load. And I was training hard, you know, so the amount of fatigue that was produced was so much lower in terms of the noise to the signal of me getting stronger. And this changes over time. So there's basically one of two things you can do. You can try to increase the stimulus so you can maintain the same signal as you get more advanced. And we know that basically just doesn't work to the same degree as you were as a novice. You can push it really, really, really freaking hard and you can get better gains as an intermediate or better gains as an advanced, but they're never going to compare to that kind of earlier stages of your career. And the other thing you can do is simply wait longer, be patient. So the problem with just trying to really, really push it is that now you're generating more fatigue. And, you know, for every unit of fatigue you're introducing, the level of stimulus is now getting less and less proportionate. You know, as a novice, you can introduce a little tiny bit of fatigue and it's almost maxing out your stimulus. And then as you become intermediate and advanced, those numbers get a little closer to each other, right? Mm. So you're introducing more noise into the system and you have to wait longer, not only because of the noise, but just because of also the limitations of how quickly you can make progress to see those changes. Yeah. So this is why you have to take different approaches, not just because, and it's not because there's something fundamentally different about you as an intermediate, advanced, or novice. It's just the rate of progress is different and the amount of work that you need to do to produce an optimal rate of gains produces slightly more fatigue, but you also get better at managing fatigue. So, if you take a too aggressive approach as an intermediate or an advanced, if you're trying to really milk everything, that can come at the cost of having more noise. And being less able to diagnose whether or not you're making progress.
I can totally relate to that. And throughout my training career, a lot of things have changed. But what I also realized is that the so to speak stimulus to fatigue ratio became like better over time. So, I mean, throughout my intermediate days. I may be intermediate right now, but a couple of years ago, I was like squatting really heavy in order to like beat the logbook and progress my numbers in the gym. And like gone up by like 50 kilos. But after that, after like taking a little break from those heavy weights and those mentality and this mentality to push it every session, I never could come close to these numbers because my technique has progressed a lot. So I mean, that's something which you all also have to consider, that throughout the training career, I mean, your whole approach or just gets more better, as you said. You're able to induce more stimulus, but you're also, maybe just getting a better stimulus to fatigue ratio out of these movements, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great example of how instead of just looking at like stimulus and the fatigue that it causes, you can do other things to improve that signal to noise ratio. You know, like a squat and a deadlift are great movements, but they may not be the best tool for someone who doesn't really care about their actual performance in those movements to grow. You know, if they can do some things that require less mental focus, you know, less connective tissue stress, you know, something like a hack squat or a weighted back extension, that can have a similar stimulus to at least most of the same muscle groups, but may be able to have more level performance and a little deuce less total fatigue into the system. So I think there's definitely something to be said for careful exercise selection and other factors so that, you know, there's one of two approaches that are popular, you know, for more experienced resistance trained athletes. And I tend to lean on the ones that introduce less noise into the system rather than huge excursions in training volume over like a mesocycle. You increase it when things aren't seem to be working, because with advanced lifters, a lot of the time, the question is not, am I making optimal progress, but how do I break a plateau? And that means you have to be able to have diagnostic information. You have to be able to tell what's going on. This is one of the reasons why, for example, Mike Tuchscher, who's an IPF coach, works with a lot of the best lifters in the world, elite lifters becoming more elite. He's focused on what's called an emerging strategies approach, where he leaves almost everything the same, creates a microcycle, and then only changes the microcycle based on the time to peak and introduces a variation as needed when it seems to not be working. So it is a backwards approach, because if the thing that is not guaranteed is progress at all, it's really, really important to be able to assess that so that you're not guessing and making assumptions. While for intermediates, you can definitely have a lot of noise in the system and still see the signal. So that's just something to consider.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, in the evidence-based community, it has become pretty clear that just progression is just an outcome of adaptation. So we are adapting, we are building muscle. That's why we can put weight on the bar. We are able to maybe do another rep. But we want to, or just as bodybuilders, as hypertrophy athletes, we want to be stronger because of bigger muscles. So in that sense, has like the beating the logbook mindset or approach any justified existence in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you're not seeing your numbers go up across the movements over some reasonable time frame, you're probably not getting bigger. So I think we can't ever lose the mindset of we do need to be seeing the output of bigger muscles. Like you said, performance should change over time. If you were lifting the exact same reps, RPE, and load on all the same movements 5 years from now, I would be really surprised if your physique looked that much different, you know? But at the same time, the beating the logbook mentality is typically thought of on a week-to-week basis. You know, you look at the same workout last time. And at the advanced level, that's just a really unreasonable proposition. Maybe you could lower your RPE by 0.5 on some movements. Maybe you can add a rep in a high rep set to, you know, like calf raise or something like that. There's going to be some week-to-week progress and if things are going well. But that mentality typically makes your RPE just kind of skyrocket, makes you have to deal with much higher fatigue levels earlier in a mesocycle. It kind of skews up your fatigue when you're trying to steadily overload, you know? So I think you have to be really careful. You know, like some of the systems out there that are built on beating the logbook are great at earlier stages where that signal to noise ratio is so much better. But if you can't expect to see visible progress in terms of performance on a week to week basis or any expected change is less than the fatigue you might be experiencing, that's where that becomes problematic. And you have to think about basically, okay, what if I do hard work for a mesocycle and then I deload and then I might see some small amount of progress. And that's when you really start to kind of have to use that baking the cake analogy. Like I did everything right. I put it all in there and you really can't make assessments when you can only expect small progress over short time frames. So I think beating the logbook is always the goal, but what is the appropriate time frame? What is the expectation? And that's where subjectivity comes into it. The athlete or the coach has to have realistic expectations at their current level where they're trying to go given their environment. So that's where like, okay, should I be able to add, you know, 5 pounds to my 5RM over 8 weeks? That's not too unreasonable. Sure. You know, I'm advanced, but I think with a good training block, I could do that, for example. And that's just kind of one way of looking at it. So absolutely focusing too much on beating the logbook in the wrong context over the wrong time frame or with unrealistic expectations of how much you beat it by. Or if you're thinking that the goal is to improve strength rather than if I am growing, strength should be going up, all of those things can get you in trouble. That can lead you down a pathway of training for strength because that will create increases in the logbook rather than thinking like I'm using the logbook as a diagnostic tool, not as the goal in and of itself.
Yeah, it's definitely like a kind of a, like a double-edged sword. If you're maybe like a guy who is usually underdosing it, you're not like mentally so strong that you can push a set to a sufficient relative intensity, maybe that mindset will get you there someday. I mean, just doing little steps each workout will add up to like a big increase over time. That might be like a good thing for those in quote unquote weaker minded individuals, but for people who are already like giving it all in a set, I mean, that will just not be realistic to beat the logbook every training session and might just push you over the hump of what would be optimal. If you're just already hitting a sufficient relative intensities. And what also needs to be considered is, of course, like the training execution, which usually tends to suffer under that mentality. I'm kind of a technique Nazi almost. I'm always giving like the technique a much higher priority than the load or the reps. But what I would like to ask you is whether the quote-unquote best technique always produces the highest amount of stimulus, and if there's a big need for standardizing that technique, or can you maybe let your technique slip here and there in order to move bigger weights? I mean, there are a lot of people who, yeah, really like that intensity training approach with a higher absolute intensity. They also push sets close to failure. I'm pretty sure you know Jordan Peters. It's always like really crazy when you see lifts like that. And I'm not, of course, not saying that they are not practicing good technique, but what you often hear is that from these guys, they say, I'll add load now and clean up the technique maybe later. Mm-hmm. But personally, I would prefer to have the technique dialed in right away at first place. I mean, what do you think?
I think probably the most important thing is just reliability, consistency. So that while, again, this is one of those things where you're not a beginner, intermediate, or advanced based on your comparison to other people's capabilities. You know, like Andy Bolton, first time he deadlift 600 pounds, was he advanced then? Nope, he was a novice. He's just a freak, you know. So it's not like if you watch a video of some of the IFBB pros, I'm thinking of like Ronnie Coleman videos from back in the day that I used to watch. You're like, oh man, he's using some body English and it's only a 3/4 rep. He doesn't lock out on his presses, you know, or he kind of stands up on each rep with the T-bar row. It's like a little bit of a hip thrust there. The thing is, though, every rep looks the same. And that's important because, again, it comes back to that signal to noise ratio. If someone is using different technique, if their form changes for them to lift heavier loads, then that is making it's removing their ability to have a diagnostic tool, right? Now they can't tell if they're getting stronger because of hypertrophy or because they are using momentum, they're using cheat reps, they've reduced the range of motion, etc. And when you reduce the range of motion, you actually change the mechanical work you're doing, which volume is a proxy for, right? So I think if you're not changing mechanical work, then you know that every set is the same as a set from last week, at least externally. Yep. You may experience it differently because of other stuff going on in your life, but the external load remains the same. And then you know that your performance can be compared to prior, prior weeks. So while there probably is some general constraints on what everyone's, you know, form should look like, that's a pretty big general constraint. Like if you have really shitty dorsiflexion, you may be doing 3/4 squats your whole career, and that doesn't matter, but YouTube will hate you, you know? but fortunately, like YouTube isn't a bodybuilding judge 6 months from now. So if you're doing 3/4 squats, that's what you can do safely, comfortably, and with your mobility constraints, and that's what you compare it to. Fantastic. You know, stick with it. Yep. So I do think you probably shouldn't make large sacrifices in consistency of technique to improve your loads. That's basically forgetting why you're trying to improve your loads. Now, you're not trying to get bigger. You're trying to beat the logbook, right? The logbook is a diagnostic tool, in my opinion. Am I progressing? Am I inducing sufficient overload over what is a reasonable time span for my level of experience? If so, the logbook should be going up. Not, I'm going to do everything in my power to move the logbook up, because that's not the same thing as growth, you know? It's almost like, instead of caring about losing body fat, and when you use the bioimpedance handheld thing, you go drink a bunch of water so your body fat percentage goes down. The goal is not to see a lower number on that screen. Yeah. The goal is actually to have lower body fat, right? So absolutely. I think, it's one of those things. And humans do this all the time. Like we get way too focused on measurement metrics, you know? Mm. For anybody who has a Fitbit and you have a step count you're trying to get to, if you find yourself, walking around your living room at the last minute, you're like, hold on, what am I doing? I'm trying to get to the step count. The whole reason I'm getting the step count is to be healthier. So is my total over average, you know, for the week step count going up? Great. Then I don't need to take walks in my living room because I'm 50 steps short before I go to bed. I'm just being OCD, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can totally relate. Also, dumped the Fitbit and just taking a step count for my phone now, which is not like the most reliable metric because I don't always have it in my pocket, but I mean over the weeks it averages out anyways, so it will be a great tool. So let's talk about a little bit about the noise factors you already mentioned. I mean, yeah, increases in training performance and the rate of hypertrophy are not always correlating to the same extent. And one could fall into the trap of following a training plan which produces the most strength increases rather than the plan which produces the most hypertrophy adaptations. And in your recent mass article, you mentioned that there are multiple studies which have shown that higher volume training resulted in the same strength increases as lower volume training, but more hypertrophy. And yeah, that was a really great article, by the way. Really enjoyed reading it. And yeah, the program which would give you like the best performance on a specific day would be like a peaking program, but that obviously does not lead to to the best hypertrophy adaptations. But I mean, what are the main factors or variables which needs to be considered when gauging performance as an indicator for hypertrophy? I mean, these neural efficiency adaptations are really most people are really well aware of that of those. Could you elaborate a little bit more?
Absolutely. So the question is basically, what are all the things that can improve strength, and then how do we control all the things that aren't muscle growth so that they're relatively similar? And there are some things we can control. There's some things we can't control. So obviously, using similar exercises over a period where you're using them diagnostically. If you were to introduce a new exercise, you're going to see rapid gains, depending on when the last time you used it was, how close it is to other things, et cetera. You know, I'll give a personal example. I go through phases where I'm only front squatting or back squatting sometimes, just depending on what my goals are. And when I switch to the other, there's like a 10% strength deficit. And I say deficit because it's where I would be if I had stuck with it. And so I see, you know, a 10% increase in strength in one mesocycle. That isn't indicative of anything except me going, oh yeah, that's how you front squat again, you know?
Yeah.
So that's not helpful, right? The other one is what we've already talked about, and that is the fact that to train, to induce a stimulus, you have to induce fatigue. They're inseparable, you know, because you have to train your body to make it grow. So the fatigue dynamics are something that you can't avoid. Exercise selection, that's something you can control. You can keep in a similar rep range, you know, because if you have within a similar rep range, then you're going to have similar adaptations that are not related to hypertrophy, like your ability to buffer, your inter-set recovery, inter-rep recovery. So if your rep ranges go from like sets of 6 to 10 and to sets of 25 to 35, that's going to be a huge, you know, change in what your performance can be, because you're not adapted to doing those high levels of workload. You know, you might go in the first week to that first set's good, you know, but then you can add 3 reps to it. And then your second and third set, they like don't drop off nearly at all compared to that first week. And you could actually double your volume, you know, like if, for example, let's say you're used to benching and then you go to doing dips. You haven't done dips in a year. Right. And you just do body weight dips. Let's say you can bench 100 kilos for 10 reps and you weigh 90 kilos. We'll just use an easy example. That's a pretty good bench, you know, very solid. And you go, okay, I can do 3x10 at 100 kilos. If you go do dips, you might get 30 reps just fresh, you know, and then you're going to probably drop to like 18 and then 15. Right. So you're doing around 40 to 50 sets of reps on body weight dips. And it's in the hypertrophy range. It's just a much lower load. It's training similar muscle groups. But you're so not adapted to it. It's a new movement and you don't have the high rep capacity. The next week, you might be able to go from 30 to 35 reps. And then instead of dropping to 18, you get to 25. And the next set's 20. So you've nearly been able to double your volume in a week. Is that really actually representative of anything? No, it's representative in your ability to, or related to hypertrophy. No, it's really representative of your ability to buffer better and then learn how to do a dip more efficiently. So those are things we can control. So now let's say, okay, we're going to stick with the same movement. We're going to stick with a similar rep range. Now we are having to deal with the fatigue generated from the training we're doing. Like you said, the thing that's going to increase your strength the most related to fatigue would be do a peaking block, you know, a taper, to see an ascent in the intensity. So you're getting better at those neurological and neuromuscular adaptations, form, technique related to the movement, but seeing the stress of training drop, And that's why tapers work. And that's why linear periodization works as far as increasing strength at a given point in time. And I think this is something that a lot of people have probably experienced once or twice if they just go from program to program, especially when they hit that intermediate stall point. They will often, just by chance, be doing a higher volume program and then switch to a lower volume program, and they'll make great gains for a mesocycle or two. And it's basically them not inducing enough of a stimulus to make much progress, but inducing a more specific stimulus, a higher intensity, at a much lower total volume. So they make some neurological gains and they dump a bunch of fatigue. And over those two mesocycles, it works fantastically. Then it tapers off. Then they kind of mess around with it for another 2 months and wonder why it stopped working. And they think, oh, I just need variation. No, you don't need variation. You stopped doing enough. And you dumped a bunch of fatigue and you found out what your actual relatively fresh capacity is. And you got better at those movements because you started lifting heavier. And the way you're testing yourself is with heavy lifting. So that's a really common dynamic. I actually myself, for everything that I even knew at the time, in 2011 and 2010, I switched to a very powerlifting, slightly modified for bodybuilding approach. And I got stuck there for around a year of training that way just because the first two mesocycles motivated me so much. I thought I'd found the golden goose. And when it stopped, you know, laying golden eggs, I couldn't figure out why. And it's because I went from a high volume approach to a high intensity, low volume approach that was, and I started testing my 1 to 3 RMs, you know? Yep. So, and I that started the plateau on my bench press that lasted multiple years. So I think it's easy to get caught up in that. And, so essentially the answer to your question, what do? Is you have to make sure that you're having some way to manage fatigue. So this involves some form of periodization, which could be deloads followed by intro weeks. And I'll discuss what those are in a second. And that you have consistent enough exercise selection on the more skilled movements so that you're not losing and regaining some level of technical and neuromuscular adaptations and staying within a similar rep range. So, for example, what that might look like is, you know, you stick with a core handful of compound movements, and you can have variation in your isolation movements because, you know what, I can come back to a push down anytime and I've pretty much lost no strength, even if I haven't done it in 2 months. But let's say we're just for ease of communication, let's say we're sticking with, you know, a squat, bench, overhead press, and a deadlift. Why not? I'm not saying they're the best movements. It's just an easy thing for people to conceptualize in terms of numbers. You might do a block where you're training in the 6 to 10 rep range, and then you might do a block where you're training in the 10 to 15 rep range. There's variation there. There's differences. You could probably argue that that's a good change in stimulus just on hypothetical grounds, but they're close enough that it shouldn't be totally different, especially after a week or two. You're sticking with the same movements. Sure, you swapped out cable curls to dumbbell curls, no big deal, but on your big tester lifts that represent your total stimulus, or I should say the total hypertrophy, those are kind of your testers. Then you can track, like you said, RPE and reps and see whether or not you're progressing over time. And most importantly, you want to look at your performance as you move into the beginning of the next mesocycle after you've deloaded, maybe after an intro week. You may go through the first mesocycle and you go, you know what, I didn't feel like that was that challenging. I'm very well subjectively recovered and I made okay progress, but nothing exciting. So I'll do a deload and then I'll do an intro week, where I kind of ramp up the volume over a couple of weeks, moving into the next block where I'm testing out a higher volume and to see how I do after that block, whether I make progress, and then the beginning of the next mesocycle. So that's essentially how you deal with it. And that example I gave is kind of like a late stage intermediate where they're expecting to see some positive change over a mesocycle. You know, every 4 weeks, can I add 5 pounds to my 10 rep max or something like that?
Yeah, you took away a lot of great points. The fatigue levels are really relevant, and that's what I what I'm observing when working with clients a lot, especially with those guys who are a little bit more advanced. They usually rarely I see big jumps within a mesocycle just because of those rising fatigue levels. It's more like after we took the deload, we reduced the fatigue, we were holding on to our fitness levels, we see that net improvements in performance. And yeah, in that sense, you're often maybe progressing without progressing on paper because fatigue levels are just masking your adaptations. Yep. Mm-hmm. And regarding the neural efficiency, you mentioned like the higher rep range and the buffering which happens there. What you usually tend to hear is that especially in those lower rep ranges, those neural efficiency might have a bigger impact on the total amount of weight. I mean, you see those incredible power lifters who don't have the most muscle mass but are incredibly strong. How does it play out in the different rep ranges, maybe even the lower rep ranges?
Yeah, so I mean, it all trickles down, but essentially the further you get away from a 1RM, the less neural efficiency is directly contributing to it. So for example, the NFL Combine is a great example of this. So the NFL Combine, for those who don't know, that's the National Football League Combine. It's kind of like this SNC strength conditioning big day where people do 40 meter sprints, they do shuttle tests, they do, most importantly, a 225 pound or 102 kilo bench press for reps. And remember, these are people trying out for the NFL, so like the average body weight here is like 250 pounds, you know. So this is people most of the time benching less than their body weight. So like, for example, I had Taylor Atwood and Ellis McLean, IPF world champions, but they're both in lower weight classes. So Taylor Atwood is a 74 kilo champ. Ellis McLean is the reigning 93 kilo champ. Back in the day, they both had pro days. They got to try out for the NFL, and both of them got 30-ish reps on 225. They're both great benchers, but I guarantee you on that day, there were individuals who had a higher 1RM bench than both of them who were, you know, or at least that year, who were doing the NFL combine. But what you can see there is that, your ability to get reps can be divergent from your 1RM when you're that extreme, when you're talking about 30 plus rep sets. Yeah. So when you're dealing with, say, a 5RM, it's probably going to be completely tied to who has a higher 1RM, or at least 90% of it. Because the further you get away from a single rep performance, the more you're relying on energy production, ability to buffer metabolites and keep going, contracting under fatigue, etc. So while your 6RM, 5RM, 4RM, 3RM are great predictors for your 1RM strength, especially if they're taken to true failure, the further you get away, the less accurate that becomes. We did a study where we took 70% of 1RM and put trash bags over the plates. This is Dr. Zerdos, his lab. They were doing this. And there was a range when we collected all the data of 6 to 29 reps on what people could get with 70% of 1RM. And that on one full side of the equation is people fantastic at doing reps. On the other side, that's people really terrible at it. And there's a lot more that goes into it than just buffering. Limb length can play into it. Muscle architecture, pain, technique breakdown, mental focus, substrate availability, perhaps what you ate that day, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we even see that volume and strength, they recover your ability to produce volume and your 1RM strength recover at slightly different time courses when you fatigue those specific performance capabilities, if you look at research. So I think it's really important to compare like to like. A lot of the powerlifters you're talking about, they have so much time under the bar to be able to move those loads the way they do. They've dialed in their technique, and they have a lot of not only just neural efficiency, but they have a lot of other adaptations that are not hypertrophy that contribute to that. So connective tissue adaptations, both intramuscularly and actually to the skeleton, things like force transference within the muscle. So, focal adhesions, lateral force transmission, the titin molecule adapting inside the muscle. There's a whole lot going on that contributes to the efficiency of force production and passive contribution of force when you're going through a stretch shortening cycle, coming out of the hole of a bench, of a squat, coming off the chest of a bench, etc. So when you see someone produce a 1RM who is trained exclusively for a 1RM, that is not reflective of their hypertrophy. It is going to be heavily influenced by it if all other factors are equal. So we do have data when you're trying to discriminate between elite level powerlifters as who's going to be stronger. More muscle thickness predicts it quite well. But when you start to compare between people who are not elite level powerlifters, the amount of variation in their strength levels is less and less and less explained by hypertrophy. And if you look at novices or like say elderly individuals, we're looking at explaining 1-3% over like the first 8 weeks of training. It's almost completely unrelated to muscle mass change. But if you take someone after the first, say, 6 weeks where we think that those technical and neurological efficiency and even a novice is predominating their strength, now we're looking at explaining more like 20%. And then there's data on more advanced lifters, and it's explaining more like 20, 30, 40, 50% of the variation. So it's essentially that the more variables you control, the more things that have only a small capacity for change within the training paradigm you have, the more you can expect changes in strength to be related to changes in muscle size.
Hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I think, yeah, just overall standardization, not only in a training technique is, just might be, really helpful in order just to know where you're going and how fast, of course. What would be like really interesting is just doing dedicated or what people may think is a good way is to do like dedicated strength phases in order to get stronger, and after that to produce more force and maybe to get more hypertrophy out of that. But as you already mentioned in the beginning of the conversation, the goal is not really to be strong, but to get stronger due to more muscle mass, right?
Yep. And one thing I would like to clarify is that if you see a powerlifter who has increased their total for the last 10 years steadily, that is absolutely a huge contributor from muscle growth. But is it necessarily the most efficient way to grow muscle for them? I would say it's the most efficient way for that process of increasing their 1RMs. But each time they're getting on the platform, they're going through a peaking cycle. They're also forced to use the squat, the bench, and the deadlift, which are not necessarily the greatest exercises to build every single muscle that contributes to them, but they are the greatest exercises to build the specific muscles that contribute to them, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So they are probably pretty close to what is the most efficient process to increase their total over time, but you could skip some of those peaking cycles, choose less demanding exercises, not go through the more intensity-driven processes, which are less stimulative for hypertrophy and more stimulative for all those other things that are specific to moving heavy loads. And that total time would accumulate over time, where you might see a bodybuilder who trained, let's say, more in a power building style, but let's say they did, you know, an RDL, they did an incline press, and they did, you know, a hack squat or something like that. They would probably not have increased their 1RMs as much, but have more muscle mass. And if you put them through a peaking block and put them through a dedicated strength block, they would see a big jump up in strength. So it's kind of, it comes down to being almost an opportunity cost in the end. Absolutely. If you are a power lifter and you're not training for hypertrophy, you're going to see a plateau in strength pretty early. You have to train for hypertrophy as a power lifter. But you also have to make sure that you're a technician. You also have to make sure that you get all of the other adaptations that you might not get from doing a 20 rep set on leg press to be able to squat a new 1RM on the platform. So there's a ton of overlap, don't get me wrong. And training for strength includes training for hypertrophy. And training for hypertrophy will result in increases in strength. So I think you can't really go wrong if you're focusing on strength. Like if you're trying to beat the logbook and you succeed in that, you might have introduced way more fatigue. You might have risked an injury here or there. You might have blown your mesocycle because in week two you were hitting failure. But if you somehow succeeded in the logbook getting beaten over the course of a year, you did enough right to grow. Likewise, that powerlifter who has increased their total over 10 years, I guarantee you they're bigger, at least in the prime movers for those exercises. Was it the most efficient way to grow? No, but it was sufficient to grow. So I think
That's
why there's a lot of debate. That's why two people can have very different opinions on what's the best way to train for size. And it's important to remember that neither one is wrong. as far as does this work, right? They both obviously work. People are getting bigger. The question is, can we make it work better? And that's where we want to make sure that we have the ability to have diagnostic tools. And you have to decide, do I want to trade my ability to diagnose or reduce or increase the time I have to look at to diagnose for added complexity or underlying assumptions or a system that may or may not be grounded in empirical evidence, you know? Do I want to have huge excursions in volume over a single mesocycle that introduces a lot of fatigue, but theoretically is better at the cost of being unable to really assess until a mesocycle or two is over? Hmm. Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, I think you summed it up really, really well. Just a follow-up question on that. Are you looking for any specific rate of progress within a certain time frame, maybe for your own journey or maybe when you're working with clients? Or is it more like if at least something is going up, that's already sufficient? I mean, the chase for like the optimal rate of progress could potentially do you more harm than good and may lead to someone operating maybe on the right side of the bell curve.
So absolutely.
Yeah. You like the grass is greener analogy.
Mm-hmm. I think that is, not assuming the grass is greener, not trying to fix something that isn't broken, and not trying to search for better progress when progress is already occurring becomes more important as your training age increases. Right. So I'll use myself as an example. I am an advanced lifter by only the metric that matters compared to myself. Uh-huh. Right. I'm not an elite power lifter because, you know, an almost 1400 total at 200 pounds is like, yeah, it's stronger than people, but it's not strong for a power lifter. Same thing with, so as far as being a power lifter, I'm an advanced lifter. As far as being a bodybuilder, I'm an advanced lifter because the, you know, my stage weight increased by 4 pounds from 2011 to 2019, you know, and I got a little leaner as well. But so the rate of progress that I can expect in powerlifting and bodybuilding is something that I can't really measure over the course of a single mesocycle or two, you know? So I have to look at historical data and what my expectations are being 16 years into lifting now for myself. So what do I expect? Okay. Well, if I'm shifting to a movement I haven't done in a while, like let's say I shifted back to low bar squats, I would expect weekly or biweekly progress that's measurable, you know, 2.5 to 5, 7.5 kilos somewhere in there. Once I have gotten back to where I was at this point, now I'm expecting changes in maybe multi-mesocycle periods. So let's say I'm training for powerlifting. I would run a volume block to try to get that muscle mass, right? And then and to get that repeated skill and to build the work capacity to train for the next phase, which would be an intensity block, where I would be more specific, lower the total volume, see some fatigue dump off and get more specific adaptations. And then I would taper and either compete or test. That might be a 9 to 10 week period. Right? Maybe 12. Mm. So I would expect to see some change, positive change on the bar over 12 weeks. But any change, 2.5 to 7.5 kilos again, would be, 7.5 would be amazing. 2.5 would be more along what I was expecting. And across all three lifts, if I didn't see any change in any of my three lifts over a 12 week block, I'd be like, I did something wrong there. Something was off. Or maybe I had a bad testing day, et cetera. So that's the kind of calculus I use as an advanced lifter. When I'm coaching someone who is a novice, I have to use my experience, published data. And when I say experience, like working with a couple hundred people, being a personal trainer with people off the street who never lifted before, and kind of knowing the difference between a novice bodybuilder and like a, I've never trained before, because they're very different. Kind of the way I look at it is if you can make microcycle-based differences, you're still a novice. You know, if we keep everything the same, your form's consistent, exercise is consistent, rep ranges are consistent, volumes are within a span but could be increasing or decreasing, whatever the goal of the block is, I should be able to see some either rep or small load improvement or a decrease in RPE if things are reasonably similar microcycle to microcycle. If you are more in the intermediate range, I'm expecting that, you know, mesocycle to mesocycle, you know, like, so let's say we're running 3 weeks deload, 3 weeks deload. Basically, when I compare week one to week one of the next mesocycle, there should probably be an improvement or a drop in RPE or an increase in load, because that's in both cases, you're fresh. So you're comparing fresh to fresh, right?
Yep, yep.
And then for an advanced lifter, I'm expecting that to occur over a string of successive mesocycles that are probably built together for a strength athlete, but might be quite homogenous for a bodybuilder. You know, I'm not going to necessarily run something that a powerlifter would consider an intensity cycle for a bodybuilder. You know, I might go from like 12 to 15 reps to 6 to 10, but I'm not doing singles at 8 RPE, you know, leading up to a taper or something like that. So I think that's a decent way of conceptualizing what's appropriate, is thinking of microcycle, mesocycle, string of mesocycles for what you could expect to see modifications on for strength.
Absolutely. Definitely. Yeah, I agree. And yeah, I think what often gets undervalued is that an increase in reps is often a really high, relative increase. I mean, if you're increasing your reps from 6 to 7 with a given weight, that's an increase of almost 17%. I mean, that's a lot. And I mean, when you're training for hypertrophy, you have to build a lot of muscle. That increase is going to happen, and you're not going to see that like each week, maybe not each mesocycle at a certain stage. So yeah, it basically comes down to trusting the process, so to speak, at a certain level of development. And I think what helps in that sense, because I mean, everyone has always like the fear of missing out, and yeah, they think the grass might be greener if we would do something else. But if you're like getting some sort of progress, maybe even throughout a macro cycle, so consecutive mesocycles, and you're like craving a deload once in a while, at least you can basically make sure that you're not underdosing volume a lot with.
Absolutely. I think it's really important to know, when should you be comparing yourself to yourself, you know? So when you're first lifting, if you're doing the same movement and you're not like hurt, underslept, something's a little weird, it should be a little bit better than last time. A rep, an RPE point down, 2.5 kilos on the bar more. And then, you know, when that's no longer possible, you've officially become an intermediate. Now you just need to compare the beginning of the block to the beginning of the last block, which typically occur after, you know, a lower volume phase or just a deload, whatever you might call it. And then, like you said, for the advanced lifter, that's when you have to let it bake a little more. You know, you do have to trust the process. You have to construct a plan, which is going to be built on a lot of your specific issues. You know, by the time you're an advanced lifter, you'll probably have a few aches and pains, niggles. You'll have discovered which mobility restrictions do and don't work for you. You'll know how your life interacts with your training, because your training's become a part of your life. You know, like certain phases of your work, your job, or your school, or something like that. So you'll have a more complex process built in. And you know how much fatigue you generate from doing certain things and how you work around it. You'll have a much more individualized approach. And you'll know, like, I have to really invest in this process for a while. And it's most of the auto-regulation and tracking and paying attention comes down to just making sure that what the intended plan is, that matching up with reality. Like, this is supposed to be a moderate stress phase. What is my session RPE afterwards? What is my perceived readiness after my warm-up sets as I go into this? What are my RPEs in general post-set? And if those are too high or too low, then you can make some adjustments on the fly to make sure that that phase is producing the appropriate amount of stimulus. Not necessarily, am I progressing at this phase? You kind of have to wait on the actual progress until some time's passed. And like you said about the bell curve, we know that there is a cost to doing too much. Not only does the fatigue create more noise, which has been the main critique I've had of having large excursions and stimulus, right, is that now you're introducing more noise into the system. But also, you can slow down your rate of progress. There are studies where we look at not greatly trained lifters, but reasonably trained lifters where doing more volume didn't produce more hypertrophy or more strength, and sometimes produces slower or lower. It's not as common. In general, if you take a group of people and you increase their volume, you're probably going to see, I'd say maybe 60% chance, just with a random sample of people. And if you're in the range of like 10 to 20 sets, if you give people one group 10 and one group 15, you have a decent chance of seeing the 15 rep set group get more strength and hypertrophy. However, you're also going to see an increase in the standard deviation of those changes as you go up. And it's typically less than that of the mean change, so that you do see significant results more often than not. But that means, like, for example, a great study is one by Abe and colleagues. It recently came out. And I think they compared three set volume groups, and there wasn't a significant difference in hypertrophy. And I can't remember the total set volumes. It might have been like 18, 14, and 10 or something like that. I'm probably getting those wrong a little bit. No significant differences between groups, but they looked at the, they broke it down into, I think, tertiles. So the top third, middle third, and bottom third of who grew the most. And then they looked at, okay, how much volume were you doing before the study? And then were you doing in the study? And when you looked at the highest responders, they had the largest increase in the number of sets they're doing compared to their start. On average, they increased their sets by 6. However, the standard deviation was 12. So 6 plus or minus 12 means that there was some reductions in volume that produced among the people who grew the most in that study. So while at the group level, looking at it in like a non-parametric way, rank ordered, you're probably more likely when you increase volume to get better. If you're already doing a lot of volume, you're more likely to grow more if you reduce volume if you're already in excess. So it is a bell curve, that U-shaped curve. And if you're already on the right of it a little bit, which doesn't mean you're not growing or you're getting smaller, it just means you're doing more work but growing slightly slower than you would with less.
Yeah.
So if you're already doing too much, which still produces progress. This is where it's a little confusing. Like,
yeah, that's a tricky point.
Yeah, you're going to see your numbers go up, but you're actually doing more than is appropriate. You're devoting more adaptive resources to recovery than you are to growing. And if you were to reduce the volume, you might actually grow faster with less total volume. So that's something that does happen, happens all the time. And I think more often than we realize among competitive athletes, not reasonably trained subjects in a study, is that because they're still seeing progress, they think they can do a little more. Okay, I'm still progressing and I'm barely surviving. This is what I need to do to progress. Maybe. Or maybe you're doing the most you can do while still making progress. And, so I think that happens a lot, because that's the competitive mindset.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of clarification regarding that topic in the past months, and that spiked up a lot of conversation, which was really great. I mean, Dr. Mike is currently like defending kind of his set increases approach, and you're promoting more like a static approach to that. And I think that's super great, because everyone, just starts to think about that, and maybe reflects, or people reflect themselves even more. That has happened to me as well. Because of that clarification. I mean, that's like, as you said, like a really funny thing that you can get like the same progress but with much more investment, and that's what like hardworking bodybuilders not always realize, because we are caught up with that hardworking mentality and that hard work basically. So that's really really cool.
And if I could clarify one thing regarding Dr. Mike Israetel and what I'm suggesting, it's not that I'm suggesting a static approach. What I'm suggesting is that volume load, which is the product of sets times reps times load, should be increasing if you're making progress, right? Because if load or reps goes up, like we talked about, that multiplicative process will be a higher tonnage. You can only increase reps or load if you're stronger, though. But you can always do another set, so long as you have the time. You know, the load might go down, the reps might go down, it might hurt you, you might be tired, it might be awful. People in the gym might be going, why are you doing your 14th set? But you can always increase volume load by adding a set, but it's not reflective necessarily of your ability to do more volume via enhanced strength from hypertrophy. It's reflective of your decision to spend more time in the gym, you know?
Yep.
So my recommendation is that sets certainly can increase in a mesocycle, but large changes in sets in a mesocycle introduces more of a noise in that signal-to-noise ratio. And since you can always add sets, but you can't always add reps and load, one can be a diagnostic tool for the other. So reps and load increases serve to tell you whether or not you are actually progressing or not, or stalled, whether that's because you're not doing enough or you're doing too much and the fatigue dynamics are too high. And from there, you can either upward or downward adjust your sets based on the diagnostic information from reps and load. But if you're increasing sets, especially in large amounts and decreasing it in large amounts, that takes away from your ability to diagnose when you may need to increase sets, because you're increasing them already, which creates the largest excursions in the total tonnage, which is reasonably reflective of the external load you're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, even though you're progressing sets over the course of a mesocycle, you basically have averages, which you can use to assess what maybe the sweet spot is. But yeah, I mean, in your mass article, you also clarified that an increase in the number of sets is a true volume increase, but you're also increasing volume by just getting stronger, doing more reps. So that by itself should like keep pace maybe with the arising overload threshold over the course of a certain time frame, maybe for your entire training career, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to be clear, there's nothing wrong with setting up a mesocycle where sets increase, you know, but you have to think about, you know, what are reasonable increases? You know, should you increase it for a whole muscle group? Should you increase it for every exercise? Should you increase it for, you know, I mean, like if you were to increase every exercise by one set, and you start at three sets, that's a 33% increase in the time spent in the gym and the total volume, you know? And if you do that again, now it's a 25% increase. So it's these large increases. If you go from like 10 sets to 20 sets, it almost forces you to stay in a cyclical process. And that's one of my main critiques, is that huge increases, and I consider that a huge one, even though the average is 15, you are going from 10 to 20 within a single mesocycle.
Yeah, that's insane.
I think it is, because it also forces you to repeat that process. You have to cycle volume because you cycled volume. It's because what are you going to do when you do 20 sets? You better do a deload. Now you've just gone from 20 to like 8, right? And after you've gone from 20 to 8, now you're a little detrained. How are you going to get ready to get back to 20? Well, you've got to start building it up. So it's this circular argument. I have to go from 10 to 20 sets because I went from 10 to 20 sets. Now, if you went from 10 to 16... that's still a large increase, don't get me wrong, but it's a lot more manageable, you know?
Yeah.
So I would say increasing sets by one every other week while you go with an RPE increase on the in-between weeks, I think that's totally tenable. And now you're not going to be introducing so much noise into the system, or doing an auto-regulated increase in sets, which is actually something Mike and I agree with. When you're capable based on certain metrics, I think absolutely. I'm not suggesting a static approach to sets. It's just that aggressive short-term, over a short-term period, increases in sets removes your ability to have that same diagnostic fidelity.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Yeah, I think Dr. Mike Isbertel just got often like kind of misunderstood with his volume landmark concept. I mean, these infographics, they show like the increase from 10 to 12 to 14 to 16 to 18 to 20 sets. And that was most of the time just due to clarification, just to make it easy to see what the stuff is all about. But I mean, those ranges are just really, really wide, and maybe too wide, especially for those advanced individuals, where the main range between your minimum effective volume and your maximum recoverable volume just is really narrow. So just increasing stuff by 100% for a muscle group is just not really productive. So that's what I also done with clients, just narrowing that range a little bit more, and it works really, really good so far. Nice.
Yeah, and I think the last thing I would say is that when you do push volumes that high in excess of what is probably ideal for hypertrophy, you are going to get adaptations, and they're going to be your ability to recover week to week, your ability to handle total volume load. So your work capacity will increase and your recovery capacity will increase. But those that's the only theoretical critique I have with Dr. Mike. The rest is just, hey, what practically makes the most sense? The magnitude difference. The only true disagreement I have is that MRV is always presented, as far as I've seen in some of these infographics and ideas, as above the optimal volume, or MAV. MRV is necessarily always above MAV, in that they're close. In reality, you could push MRV up really, really, really high by getting really good at recovering week to week, increasing your frequency, getting a really robust repeated bout effect, and increasing your work capacity a lot. But there is no reason that MRV couldn't be 2 to 3 times what your MAV is. And that is indicated by, for example, Abe, where, you know, that 6 ± 12, that some people, they were training with, you know, six more sets than they went into in the study. And then they started growing in the most effective group. So it makes me think that a volume-centric approach can get you really good at doing volume, but it may be a volume far in excess of what you're capable of growing from effectively.
Yeah, doing more sets gets you better at doing more sets. And yeah, I mean, there might be some potential benefits regarding functional overreaching, maybe when you have that deload period afterwards. But functional overreaching, I mean, overreaching is kind of like defined by your recovery, which is at the moment the return to baseline performance. And it's as we also mentioned in the first conversation, it's the definition for recovery is not holistic enough to really tell, okay, I'm overreaching right now. For me, it was just always like kind of hard to know, okay, that's overreaching and that's not. I mean, you would practically see a decline in your performance to know that you're really per definition overreaching, and that's not happening, at least not for me or for my clients. First they get ill, or they just feel horrible before their performance starts to decrease, actually. So overreaching was not really like a real thing for me, at least.
It requires you to guess, right? So the more assumptions, guesses, and gambles that a system requires, the less diagnostic ability it has for the practitioner. And I can tell you, anyone who trains people and deals with them one-on-one rather than just speaking in theory, if you're actually getting reports from your clients, they're depending on you. If you have to assume when they're overreaching, guess what their volume landmarks are. You can't use progress until you've had multiple deloads or something like that. You're hoping that this overreaching will produce better progress than something that had less noise versus the signal. That's an uncomfortable place to be. And it's also very difficult for someone to get buy-in, you know. So I'm almost always in favor of a system which gives you more diagnostic ability rather than something that might theoretically get you faster gains. Because again, with the populations I work with, you know, competitive pro-natural bodybuilders, very high-level power lifters, or just anyone who is a relative late-stage, intermediate, or advanced relative to their own capability, like I was talking about before, being able to reliably see progress is everything. if I can see your total going up, if we can see your physique improve over time, that's what matters, you know? So if I can go right, we have seen improvements across the board for this bodybuilder in their 6 to 8 rep range on their core lifts. That's what I want. Not going, well, they might have overreached and this could be a fitness fatigue dynamic and maybe next time after the deload. Like, so I think the cleaner the system is, the more you can know whether it's working. That is a psychologically very helpful, and it's very helpful for the practitioner as well to have confidence and to be able to assess the efficacy of what they're doing.
Awesome. Hey, Eric, I think, we summed up a lot of great points, and that will definitely, help the people to like clear the fog around, their training performance and see a little bit more clearly and identify whether they're growing or they're just like ramping up their numbers just for the sake of it. And I think that was a really great discussion. So any final words regarding that topic? Something?
No, I think the main thing I would just advise people is to don't stray towards black and white thinking. This is not a question of whether increasing sets in a mesocycle is good or bad. It's a question of what's a reasonable increase of sets in a mesocycle. What is the cost to increasing sets in a mesocycle and to what degree? And how can I tell if I'm actually progressing? So these are the questions we need to ask, you know, is my ability to recover and produce work the same as my ability to grow? Could the system I'm following be increasing one of those and not the one I want at the expense of the other? So that's basically the final words I have.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time. Same as last time, I will link the 3D Muscle Journey website, your podcast with Omar, the Iron Culture podcast, and of course the Mass Research Review in the show notes. So everyone can check that out. Any other stuff you want to plug? Anything which is coming on currently, or is it?
No, that's good, man. That's good. That's plenty. I always appreciate the shout out, man.
Of course. So at the end of each episode, we want to put a track on our Spotify playlist, which is called Hypertrophy Cast Playlist. Last time you gave us three excellent songs from your favorite playlist. So any new song which you may have listened to during quarantine? Or
oh man, what I've been listening to lately, was training at home with my wife during quarantine, so we were playing a lot of like funk.
Nice.
So I don't remember the specific songs, but anything by the Gap Band is typically great. If you like funky workouts. So, yeah.
The Gap End?
The Gap Band.
The Gap Band. Okay, yeah I'm going to note that. I'm just going to listen through their five most popular songs and just going to pick one of those.
Can't go wrong.
Nice. Okay, I'm going to put Through the Fire and the Flames from Dragon Force on the playlist. I'm not sure whether you know this. Really great. No, definitely go listen to it. I know it from a Guitar Hero.
Oh, you know, okay, sure, game?
Yeah, for sure. It was one of the hardest song to beat back then. A friend of mine, he was like ridiculous in that game, and I watched him play, and this song is dope as well. So that sparked a lot of childhood emotions. So yeah, I'm gonna put that on the playlist. Definitely give that a listen. I'm pretty sure you're gonna like it. It's pretty cool. So
cool.
Yeah, Eric. Hey, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure, man.
Week and talk to you soon, man.
You too, buddy.